This Frontenas podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Central American women who seek asylum in the U.S. are often victims of physical or sexual violence at home. It's something they also experience on the route through Mexico. Their traumatic experiences often don't end at the border. The women and their children experience detention and sometimes separation. Many share stories of being held in hieleras, frigid holding cells, or perreras, cage-like fenced structures described by migrants as dog kennels. Lori Cook Heffron is a professor of social work at St. Edward's University in Austin. She undertook a study to examine the consequences of detention on the survivors of violence. Joining Cook Heffron on Fronteras today is a co-author of the study, licensed psychologist Gabriela Hurtado. They interviewed 29 previously detained women and professionals who work with immigrant women in Austin, Houston, and San Antonio. The interviews took place in 2016 and 2017, and the study was published in 2018. Cook Heffron explains why the study was necessary.
I think our impetus for this study was, one, we were recognizing that the systems of detention were expanding, or experiences of detention, the length of stay, perhaps. We were in a period of all of that expanding. I think we also were recognizing that while there was beginning to be more and more focus and attention towards the negative and harmful impact of detention itself, there was still a need for greater information and understanding and attention to what happens when people are released and the needs they might have, the way service providers and advocates and activists can better meet folks' needs upon release from detention. And so our goal was to hear from folks directly impacted by detention, survivors themselves, but also hear from folks who work directly with them, immigrant rights advocates, immigration attorneys, rape crisis center advocates, et cetera, in hopes of documenting the needs of women as they describe their needs themselves, such that ideally our responses could be improved for folks and communities.
And so, Gabby, what was it that you found when you were interviewing these women who were in detention? I'm sure you heard stories of separation or maybe some of the past traumas that these women suffered. Can you tell us a little bit about what you discovered when you were doing the study?
Meeting with women and having them tell their story, they were able to give us a different perspective than you would usually hear in the media or even sometimes from providers. We were able to listen to what led to them deciding to make the trip, what were some of the worries and concerns that they had before then, what happened once they arrived to the United States and how they were treated, what were some of the thoughts that they had as they were arriving. A lot of them, I think, thought once they arrived here they were going to be safe, and once they were at the border, they were surprised by the level of violence that they were met with and how punitive it seemed the entire process when they were asking for help when they arrived at the border. And then we heard about their experience within the detention system and how chaotic it seemed at times because the rules seemed to not be written out and spelled out, and things seemed to change quickly, including the expectations of what their behavior was supposed to be and how they were supposed to mother their kids within the detention center. And then we heard more about how their life was now that they were released and what are some of the challenges that they were having, how difficult it was for them to get a job because of transportation limitations, how some of them were carrying some grilletes.
The ankle monitors?
Yeah, mm-hmm. The ankle monitors, and how much stigma sometimes that costs during transportation and in order to ask for a job. And also how that had impacted their family and the relationship they had with their kids and their ability to feel safe and protected as a mom and as a woman.
Gabby, these women have suffered some sort of sexual or domestic violence prior to coming here. What kind of trauma did you find they encounter while in detention, psychological violence that they were encountering while in detention?
We did hear a few stories of women who said that the guards in the detention center they were at were aggressive towards them, and it was unclear as to where the aggression was coming from or what to expect sometimes, or threats being made to them about being held in a detention center longer if they continue to ask questions about their process. And so when people ask questions about their process, it would be met with aggression. Also around being able to get medical attention. Sometimes there was a lot of reactivity about being able to provide getting that service for their kids and for them, and especially when the women felt like it was not enough or the problem was not being solved in their fight for their rights to get medical attention. They were often met with emotional and I would consider psychological abuse.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that we noticed and that we have written about is for many of the women who've experienced intimate partner violence in their past, some of the strategies their abusers may have used mm-hmm. to maintain or gain power and control over them that we know about in the domestic violence world seem to be replicated in some ways in detention. So some of those things might be insults, humiliation, intimidation. Gabby mentioned threats. So we spoke with one woman who had asked guards or an immigration official about her bond. And the bond is the amount of money that someone might have to pay to be released. And unlike the criminal justice system, in the immigration detention system, the bond is paid in full. And she had asked about how much she owed. She reported to us that the guard said, if you ask one more time, I'm going to raise your bond. So an example of sort of intimidation tactics or threats, another strategy that is similar to maybe what women have experienced in their own interpersonal relationships is that of isolation. So women in detention are socially isolated from the rest of the community. Many detention centers are in rural areas, though not all. They might be isolated from other women. There may be periods where they're isolated from their own children. They're definitely isolated from the kinds of providers, be they mental health professionals, immigration attorneys, advocates, et cetera, that might want to be able to provide services and or just solidarity with them. Many women have the opportunity to work while they're in detention, but might be paid as little as $1 a day or $3 a day. Some feel that it is not a choice whether or not they work. So we have these elements that sort of feel similar to maybe an intimate partner violence relationship or even a relationship of exploitation or human trafficking. In addition, as Gabby mentioned, while we didn't interview women who had experienced physical or sexual abuse inside detention, we know that there have been stories of that. And while we were working on this project, there was a very public case in the Hutto detention facility outside of Austin, Texas, of a woman who reported sexual violence while detained there.
We're talking with Lori Cook Heffron, a licensed social worker and professor of social work at St. Edward's University in Austin. We're also speaking with licensed psychologist Gabriela Hurtado. Cook Heffron and Hurtado are co-authors of a study with Josie Serrata of Casa de Esperanza, National Latino-Latina Network for Healthy Families and Communities. The study is entitled Latina Immigrant Women and Children's Well-Being and Access to Services After Detention. When we come back,
it's not necessary to be detained in order to seek asylum.
More with Lori Cook Heffron and Gabriela Hurtado. Plus, the story of a young boy who crossed from Mexico into Texas with his family at the age of 5. His mother was deported when he was in high school, and now he's a college graduate.
Even if I get paid, like, on one of the lower ends, like, that's a lot more than we're used to.
It's all coming up on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Lori Cook Heffron and Gabriela Hurtado are co-authors of a study that examines the consequences of detention on Central American women who've experienced a pattern of violence in both their home countries and on the migration route to the U.S. Cook Heffron is a licensed social worker and professor of social work at St. Edward's University in Austin. Hurtado is a licensed psychologist in Austin. They found that the confusion in detention facilities adds to the experience of trauma. Many detained women are sometimes unaware they have to pay bonds of up to $15,000 or of the laws surrounding the asylum process, which seem to always be in flux. Cook Heffern says detention shouldn't be the answer. There are better solutions.
Detention is harmful to adults and children. It's harmful to women and men. It's harmful to families. And it's particularly harmful to folks who've already experienced these multiple incidents and episodes of violence and trauma. And that what we also know is that it's not necessary to be detained in order to seek asylum. We do have models, we have experiences, we have past practices that allow folks who've experienced persecution to seek asylum from the community. We have community-based alternatives that allow survivors of violence to get the mental health support, the social support from their families and friends, the legal advice while living in community with other folks. And so I think we hope that this report also supports that idea. One of the things we also know is that oftentimes those community-based alternatives to detention are more cost-effective. So they cost less, they're less harmful, they're more humane.
And so, Gabby, you brought up medical issues with many women who have been released from detention, and that's one of the other recommendations that the study makes, is to help expand that kind of support. Who is your audience here for this study? Who are you hoping takes this information and acts upon it?
Of course, the government in charge of these facilities and the organizations that work with them, but also the providers that are out in these communities. And, you know, once women are released from the centers, need to provide services for these women in what are the contexts that these women are living in and surviving in so that we are able to meet their needs. I think it'd be fantastic to have providers that have a background on trauma-informed care and services so that we're able to meet the needs of the women in a way that can really reach them and can really take into consideration their context and the full picture of these women.
Mm-hmm. And it's got to be more difficult in smaller communities where there are detention centers. I mean, you did your study in Austin and San Antonio, and those are larger cities with a good amount of medical professionals, maybe a lot of them who work with the immigrant community or the migrant community. But have you heard anything about maybe some of the smaller communities? Like, for example, in Donna in the Rio Grande Valley, they're now going to open another a temporary tent facility because of the number of migrants coming through the Rio Grande Valley. How do you think they could manage providing that type of mental health or physical health support to many of the migrants, Gabby or Lori?
You know, oftentimes in immigrant detention centers, there is not access to outside providers. And I don't know whether or not that will be the case in the new centers. So that's something to pay attention to, is how the degree to which the services either are already provided within those centers and or how porous those centers become to allow other professionals to come in. But I also think one of the things that makes the response difficult is that what you're saying about detention centers housed in small or rural or isolated communities. But also what we're seeing is that when women are released, we were interviewing folks who stayed in Texas. However, what we know about folks is that they're going all over the United States. Once they're released from detention, oftentimes dropped off at a bus station, they're making their way to North Carolina, to Chicago, to Los Angeles, et cetera. And so part of the response needs to take that into account and make sure the providers on the other end of that bus trip are also aware of the things Gabby mentioned, aware of the kinds of trauma and or abuse under just conditions that people have been surviving in. We would hope that medical professionals, pediatricians, mental health professionals, but also rape crisis centers and domestic violence shelters, all of those folks who might have great awareness and training in some of these areas but might not know the specifics of the migration journey and or the harmful impacts of detention itself. If they can build that into their own response to women, I think that'd be important. But also part of this is just the logistics of how to make sure that women themselves are aware of the resources that are existing in their destination town or city. And we still have a lack of smooth response for folks to help really make sure they're getting connected up with the services that do exist across the U.S.
Yeah, I think there's been some effort to put information together, and sometimes that information may or may not be available in a language that people understand, but also at a level of understanding for most people. Sometimes it can be very academic resources. And so not everybody is going to first know how to find them or how to navigate some of them. And so I think making things accessible, or sometimes even before people leave, having some sort of pamphlet information, something that they can hold on to as to how to connect or find resources in the area, mm-hmm. I think would be helpful.
What I think is interesting is the study was done 2016, 2017, right at the beginning mm-hmm. of the Trump mm-hmm. administration, before the zero tolerance policy of 2018. Yeah. I'm wondering if the wheels are already turning in both of your heads about a sort of a follow-up study to see, you know, just in those 2 years from 2016 to 2018, how much has changed.
I laugh because we were just talking about this in our drive here about, you know, we know that things have changed dramatically since we did the study. And we wonder what the impact is, not only on the women, but also on the systems supporting them. And what are some of the new needs that we're seeing? And how can we apply or expand some of these findings to mm-hmm. them?
Exactly. The other piece that I think would be nice to highlight are the roles that previously detained women are taking on in advocacy. Mm-hmm. Some of the women that we talk to and or that we just hear about are really active in making sure that detained women are recognized or not forgotten, and in building solidarity and relationships with other women after they're released. And so I think those networks seem to be growing, and they're very exciting, and being able to sort of lift up and highlight the work that those women are doing would be important.
We've been talking with Lori Cook Heffron and Gabriela Hurtado. Cook Heffron is a licensed social worker and professor of social work at St. Edward's University in Austin. Hurtado is a licensed psychologist in Austin. They're co-authors with Josie Serrata of the study, Latina Immigrant Women and Children's Well-Being and Access to Services After Detention. To hear more of our conversation and to find a link to the study, go to tpr.org. Oscar Cantua was one of 5,100 graduates at the 2019 spring commencement at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He received an undergraduate degree in physics. It stemmed from an early interest in black holes. Cantua's path to graduation was a rocky one. He, his mother, and older sister left Mexico when Oscar was only 5.
She's been working factory jobs or like very manual labor jobs since she was a young girl, and so she wanted us to have an opportunity to have higher paying jobs that wouldn't require us to be on our feet like 24/7.
The family ended up in Sinton, Texas, about 26 miles north of Corpus Christi. They stayed with a family friend.
I came in the middle of the school year, but fortunately I had been going to like a bilingual school in Mexico. So I was able to communicate with all the kids, and the majority of the people at my school were actually like of some sort of Hispanic Latino origin. So I was able to make friends pretty quickly, especially being like new kid and being able to talk in Spanish, being from Mexico. So it was certainly easier than it could have been.
It should be said that Cantua is a U.S. citizen through his father, who was born in Oakland, California. His mother and sister are Mexican citizens. Cantua's sister is about 7 years older, and her father died before Cantua was born. Cantua says his mother's deportation came out of the blue, just as he finished his sophomore year of high school. He and his mother had made a trip to Corpus Christi to find him a laptop.
And on the way back, we were about to turn into the road that my house was on, and she ended up getting into the turning lane without signaling, which immediately we saw cop lights. He was asking, and she didn't know very much English, and she was also very nervous. And so I was answering. I don't know if he didn't like that, but he asked her to step out the vehicle and ordered me to stay inside. I didn't know what was happening until he was suddenly putting her in handcuffs for some reason.
It wasn't much later that his sister decided to return to Mexico.
My sister left right after she graduated high school. She was trying to go to college, but we didn't have the money. DACA, like, came into effect literally the year right after she graduated. So she decided to just go back to Mexico with our family.
Cantua made the decision to stay in Sinton and finish school.
I could have gone back to Mexico, like, try to finish school there and, like, live with her. My dad offered to take me in again, like, be with his family. But because I was so used to Sinton and, like, I had built up, like, a decent reputation in the school, I had a lot of extracurriculars. So there was a lot of things that I would have had to sacrifice in order to move somewhere else.
Gantua was fascinated by black holes since elementary school. He knew by middle school he would major in physics. But Gantua knew he would have to find a way to leap the financial hurdle to get to college. He applied for the Top Scholar Program at the University of Texas at San Antonio. It's a merit-based four-year scholarship that includes tuition, fees, room and board, and auto-enrollment in an honors program.
I was invited here during the spring of my senior year to interview, and I got the scholarship, and so that was my entryway.
Gantua says he knows this is the path he wants to follow, a life in academia and research. His mother tells him to make sure he's happy.
She always worries, like, is there actually money in this? Are you going to be starving? And I tell her, no, I mean, it might take a while, but it's a comfortable life. And it's, even if I get paid, like, on one of the lower ends, like, that's a lot more than we're used to.
Gantua left for Mexico right after graduation to spend time with his family. He says he'll take a year off and start applying to graduate school with the goal of getting a PhD. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Brie Kirkham. And our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.